Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Norman Swan and you're listening to The Health Report. In this program, getting genes to shut up as a treatment for inherited problems. Another inherited condition that's under-recognised in Australia, which can show up as early osteoarthritis in families, and a row which has been going on in the United States this past week about a newish test for heart disease which is also proving popular in Australia. It's a CT scan which shows up the coronary arteries. American experts are seriously questioning its value and they're supported by a statement from the American Heart Association. The issue is whether the claimed benefits of the technology are being distorted by the money to be made from it. The technical name for the X-ray scan is CT angiography, and I spoke to someone who's been keeping a weather eye on CT scanning of the heart for quite a few years. He's Professor Phil Harris of the University of Sydney and Royal Prince Alfred Hospital.
It's using the common or garden type CT scanner, but evolution of those scanners has increased the ability of those scanners to see down to very small details in the body. And so by injecting the patient with contrast medium or dye that shows up on X-ray, it is now possible to obtain quite detailed pictures of the coronary arteries that supply the blood to the heart, and they have only a diameter of about 4 millimetres. What you're looking for is to try to pick the atherosclerosis, the disease in the walls of these arteries that underlies common or garden heart attacks.
And this injection's into the veins, it's not into the arteries like you do with a coronary angiogram.
That's right. It's about 120 mils of dye injected with a power injector into a vein, and so the patient can just get up and walk out.
And what about the movement of the heart and the heartbeat? You know, when you're used to having an X-ray, you've got to take a deep breath, stay still forever.
And that's been the challenge for the technology, and it's why it's taken so long for CT scans to get there. You still have to hold your breath, and the problem is, of course, with each heartbeat it moves, and as they've been able to make the scanners to move faster and faster, triggering the imaging in relation to the heartbeat, they've been able to capture the pictures in such a way that effectively freezes the heart.
Now, I've seen some of these CT angiograms. They're beautiful pictures. I mean, they look fantastic.
No, they are, particularly when they do the three-dimensional reconstructions. They show enormous amounts of information.
But the American Heart Association suggests the information isn't worth much.
I don't think it's suggesting it isn't worth much. It's saying we don't know at the moment what the full potential for this information is. And the one caution that it is giving is that there shouldn't be a rush to do these scans in asymptomatic people. And they're saying that for a number of reasons.
Are you seeing many people coming in here to a regular cardiology clinic with these scans?
Well, yeah, it's not uncommon for patients to have seen the publicity, to have gone and got one done, and they present you with a CD and you look at the pictures and it's showing atherosclerosis in their arteries. And then, of course, from a cardiologist's point of view, the hard work begins.
Because is it significant?
If the patient has atherosclerosis, that's always significant. But the real question is, what should we do about it? And more importantly, is there anything that we can do to improve or change the patient's prognosis, their outcome? Of course, the patient always says, well, there's some narrowings there, get rid of them. But there's good trial evidence that that doesn't necessarily improve the patient's outcome.
So in other words, if you don't have any symptoms, you're not got angina or chest pain or breathlessness on exertion, and all you've got some blockages, you could get a 19-year-old off the street and probably got blockages.
Well, not 19-year-old, but certainly most middle-aged males are going to have atherosclerosis, and that comes as a shock to the middle-aged males who have these scans.
But I thought that when you do postmortems on 19-year-olds, you do see significant...
Well, yeah, you can find some 19-year-olds who'll have disease. But, of course, one of the advantages of this test, and one of the strengths that's already coming through, if it's a negative test, that's probably highly significant. It almost certainly means 98% certainty that the patient does not have atherosclerosis. You can really pat yourself on the back and say, that's fantastic. It's the others who do have it that are the problem.
And, of course, the attraction here is that, or the theoretical attraction here, is that you don't get admitted to a clinic for a day case and have a needle in your thigh and catheters with all the risks associated with that.
Well, the cardiologists are all doing their planning on the basis that the widespread use of these CT scans will in fact create more people having that traditional X-ray coronary angiogram that you just described. The concern is it will identify many more asymptomatic patients if the scans are used unwisely who will be having coronary angiograms who wouldn't otherwise have them. Now, they may have them with a view to putting in a stent if we find something, but there certainly, we think, will be more coronary angiograms, and that worries us.
Is there anybody around who's prepared to either operate on the coronary arteries or go straight to a stent based on the CT angiogram?
Well, there's no way of avoiding the catheter because to put in a stent, you've got to take the pictures, and nobody would proceed to put in a stent unless the pictures before you put in the stent confirmed there was a significant narrowing.
And what about a cardiothoracic surgeon just going straight to bypass?
To my knowledge, there are no cardiothoracic surgeons who would be prepared to go to bypass operation based on a CT angiogram alone. There may in the future, but not at the moment. Because there's often an intermediate step in this, because what all of the guidelines issued by the learned bodies are saying is that if the patient has evidence, even though they don't have symptoms, if there's evidence of a restriction of the blood supply when they're exercising, then there may be justification for going ahead to put in a stent or to do a bypass operation.
So in other words, they do a stress exercise test.
That's right. Or one of the best tests to do in this situation is to inject a radionuclide agent and do an exercise sestamibi scan.
What's the scan?
It's called a sestamibi scan, and it basically is what's called a perfusion scan, where the isotope will be taken up uniformly by the heart muscle. But if there's a restriction in the blood flow, then you'll see a cold spot on the scan, giving evidence that during exercise, because this is done during exercise, that there is a significant restriction of the blood flow. So one of the problems that we're seeing is that many patients are getting the triple whammy of radiation dose, because radiation dose is one of the concerns here, that they have their CT coronary angiogram, then people say, well, it's not justified to do anything if they're asymptomatic, but if they're getting ischemia, then we probably would want to do a coronary angiogram, put in a stent. So then they go and have the sestamibi scan,
which is more radioactivity.
And then they have the coronary angiogram, which is more radioactivity. So in the background of all of this, there is some concerns about the radiation doses that people are accruing.
So in summary, where we've got to here is that they make pretty pictures.
Yep.
You do see probably more on them in terms of atherosclerosis than you do on the catheter, because it's showing you the wall of the artery.
Yep.
But the concern is that there's lots of people that you don't know enough about who are not getting any symptoms, and they've just got this and you haven't got a clue what to do for them.
There is a growing body of evidence. I think it's a bit too early yet to be putting into practice, but I think we probably will be if the evidence continues to be good, that they play a role in association with the emergency department, particularly in the hospital where there is no cardiac catheterisation, laboratory coronary angiography is not possible, where the patient is admitted with chest pain. The initial assessment shows it's probably not cardiac, but there is a need to go all the way, and so you can do one of these tests, and if that's negative, the evidence from the studies is the patient can go home because they're in the clear. In other words, it may speed up that whole process of assessment that's going on of patients with chest pain in the emergency department.
But you'd need to have a latest generation CT scan.
You've got to have the latest generation CT scan, and there are have a number of those that are being purchased around in the public hospital system just to cater for this particular situation. If the patient has chest pain and there is evidence that the patient has ischemia...
Meaning lack of blood.
The lack of blood supply. There's good evidence that their symptoms are coming from coronary disease, then they should go on and have a coronary angiogram, probably with a view to proceeding with a stent at the same time.
In other words, the CT angiography is a waste of time.
CT angiography just adds an unnecessary test and an unnecessary dose of radiation. Somewhere in there, there is a group of patients who probably ought to have a CT coronary angiogram, but we don't know who it is at the present time. It's too early to begin to describe it to you.
But it's not part of your annual checkup.
Certainly not part of your annual checkup.
Where in all this sits the exercise stress test? Because there was a vogue 10 or 15 years ago that was part of your annual checkup. You had an exercise stress test, and it did exactly the same thing.
Yep.
People who had no symptoms, it delivered a whole sort of people you didn't know what to do with. And now people are saying, I understand, I just want to check this, is that that's just something to have where you have symptoms and you're not absolutely sure what's going on.
The stress test has a diagnostic role and certainly helps in... I mean, most patients who have chest pain it's hard to decide on their label. There's some that come along with absolutely classical chest pain. You say, this is from the heart, and you don't need to do any more tests. You just go straight to coronary angiography. But there's many patients who you can't be certain.
They get a bit of toothache with exercise or something like that.
Toothache with exercise is probably almost certainly is from their heart. It's more the patient who says, my pain's sharp, and sometimes it occurs when I'm doing nothing, but it also occurs when I walk up a hill. But when I stop walking up the hill, it takes 20 minutes to go away. It doesn't go away immediately. So it has what we call atypical features. And an exercise test is very good at sorting that out because, first of all, you get to know what their exercise capacity is, and exercise capacity is one of the strongest predictors of prognosis. A person with a good exercise capacity is probably almost certainly going to live for a long time. You get to see what the chest pain is like under exercise, so they report to you as they're doing it, what they're feeling, and plus you see the changes on the electrocardiogram, which may indicate that the patient's getting ischemia. As a screening test for the annual checkup, doesn't have a lot of endorsement from any of the learned bodies. There's a few asymptomatic people walking around in the population who do have extensive disease and don't know it. It'll pick those out. They're 1 or 2%. Now, you might say, well, so will a CT coronary angiogram, but the costs are a little higher there and probably not so worth it.
And as opposed to the CT scan, what the exercise test is doing is presumably is giving you the function.
That's right. It's the functional assessment that you don't get from the CT angiogram.
Bottom line here is there might be a role in the emergency situation, but in terms of the general assessment of somebody who's sick, it's probably not a huge role at the moment.
At this stage, but there's an enormous amount of research going on to try to work out where the role is. And I think in the future there will be a role because there is very important technology. And there's even one area we haven't touched on. There's one situation where it may be of enormous potential. The reason that patients have a problem with coronary atherosclerosis is because plaques rupture. And when a plaque ruptures, a clot forms there, and that causes the sudden severe acute episode of chest pain or even the full-blown heart attack, even cardiac arrest. In our current state of knowledge, we're not very good at predicting when or if a plaque rupture is going to occur or which area of the atherosclerosis it's likely to occur, because we know that when you see this atherosclerosis, it's generally extensive, but it's just one spot where the rupture occurs. Now, we know that it's the morphology of the plaque that's important, and it's the soft, fatty ones. Yeah, the soft, fatty ones that rupture, not the hard, calcified ones. And that's the problem with putting a stent in a particular area, because it's probably the more severe one that's been there a long time.
It's the safer one.
Yeah, that's the safe one. It's the other one upstream, the soft, mushy one that's going to cause you the problem. And so there is some evidence that CT scanning will be good at telling us about the constitution of the plaques and maybe which ones are rupture. It also has some roles, I should say, in particularly where there's anomalous coronary arteries, because there are a number of people who are born where the coronaries run in different courses than they would normally. And in some of those situations, the patients are at risk. Coronary angiography is not very good at being able to tell the high-risk patients. And it also is pretty good in people who've had bypass operations. It may be that when we've got enough data, that doing a regular check on a patient who's had a bypass operation is of value, because it does image the bypasses very well.
Phil Harris is Professor of Medicine at the University of Sydney and Clinical Director of Sydney Southwest Area Health Services Cardiovascular Service. And if you want to know more about this issue, we'll have the reference to the American Heart Association statement on our website. And you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Speaking of tests, the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and the Royal Children's Genetics Service in Melbourne have announced the piloting of a Victorian-developed test which can detect an under-recognised inherited disease involving the eyes, the ears and the joints. As you'll hear, some Australian adults could find the effects of the gene defect sounding surprisingly familiar. In full-blown form, it's called Stickler syndrome, and one of the people who developed the test is Associate Professor Ravi Savarirayan.
Stickler syndrome is a condition described initially in the 60s that has quite a myriad of manifestations. It can affect the eye, causing retinal detachment. It can affect the hearing apparatus, causing deafness. And very importantly, it also can affect the bones and joints and cause short stature and quite debilitating arthritis. So it's a condition with many different parts, and it can actually present as many different things, and it's probably under-recognised in the community.
How would you know that if this runs in your family, given that you're saying it's under-recognised? I mean, if something like muscular dystrophy, you know if that's running in your family because it's such a devastating illness But how would you know this is running and not recognise it as such?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose some people come to us with classic symptoms, such as things such as spontaneous retinal detachments, meaning they can be watching television or driving their car home from work and suddenly lose vision in one eye due to detachment of the back of the eye. Some babies are born with cleft palates, and this can be the first sign. Stickler syndrome is the commonest condition associated with a cleft palate. And then very recently we've discovered that other families can just present with early osteoarthritis, and some of those families also have abnormalities in the same gene that causes Stickler syndrome. So it's really a wide manifestation of conditions, and rather than being one condition, it's probably best viewed as a family of different conditions.
So the classic one where you've got this sort of flattened face, short stature, problems with your joints and eyes, that full house is actually not the full picture, so to speak.
No, that would be the sort of barn door Stickler syndrome, but then we have all of these other related conditions that we now know are caused by abnormalities, mutations, spelling errors in the same gene, which is the gene for collagen type 2, and they're really variable, and they can present from a family that just has early osteoarthritis of the joints to lethal conditions where children's bones form so badly that they do not survive because they have a very small chest cage and their lungs don't develop. So it's a huge spectrum of presentation.
And if you're in a family where you've developed osteoarthritis early, does the retinal detachment risk go with that?
We don't think so. We think that there are some families in which the eye risk is lower and it's just limited to the joints, the cartilage. But we have to try and do more research regarding this, because the families that we have with the premature arthritis, they don't seem to have any other manifestations suggestive of Stickler syndrome or any of the other conditions. And what we're trying to do is raise the awareness in paediatricians and rheumatologists and other people who might see these patients, because they may not get to the geneticist and it may not even be suspected that they have a condition that they can be tested for and that they may be able to pass down to their children.
And in fact monitor themselves. And we should say that retinal detachment, what we're talking about here, is where the, if you like, the cinema screen at the back of your eye, which registers light and transfers it to electrical messages to the brain, the wallpaper, if you like, comes off and you stop seeing.
That's correct, yes. And unfortunately, in these conditions, you may not get any warning symptoms. They can just be catastrophic and massive and occur spontaneously. So obviously, the best way to be aware of this is to know that the predisposition exists and to see an ophthalmologist so that surveillance can be performed. And in some cases, where it looks like the retina may be about to detach, preventative laser surgery can also be performed. So it's actually useful from a practical point of view for the families.
Thousands of people have retinal detachments each year in Australia. Presumably just an isolated retinal detachment is not cause for concern that you've got Stickler syndrome.
No, that's true, but Stickler syndrome is actually the most common cause of inherited retinal detachment. So where we have situations where someone's had a retinal detachment and there's a vague family history, like often there is in families, of great-grandmother or grandmother having some problems with her vision, but we're not really sure what, some of these families may have a genetic cause, and Stickler syndrome is one of the more common ones. So again, it's not really to say everyone needs these tests. It's probably just to say that there are probably a lot more families out there than we recognise, and we're only really looking at the tip of the iceberg.
And what does this gene do? You say it's for type 2 collagen, but what does it actually do?
Type 2 collagen is the most important protein that's present in hyaline cartilage, which is the lubricant and shock absorbers for our joints. It's present in the jelly of the eye called the vitreous. It's also important for the inner ear structures for transmitting sound to the brain. And also it's present in the spine as well, because the spine also has hyaline cartilage around the bodies of the spine.
And of course, so really, here we're also talking about deafness, aren't we?
Correct. So it's one of those conditions where the special senses, not only vision but hearing, can be affected. So it's obviously a very important condition. If you look at arthritis, hearing and vision, this can have a devastating burden for families.
And what's this test you're announcing?
Several years ago, when I was doing my doctorate at the Murdoch, we looked at starting a test for Stickler syndrome, because we had many families and there were many more around Australia, and we were able to develop the test and offer it to a very few families in a research setting. Over the last few years, we've worked very hard to bring that test to the laboratory, and we are now able to offer it through the Victorian Clinical Genetic Services Laboratory at the Children's Hospital, and are now going through our backlog of families with possible type 2 collagen problems to test all of them, with an aim of offering it more widely around Australia and the region.
When would that might be that you'd offer it more widely, if somebody's listening to this in Geraldton or in Hobart?
Well, at the moment, the pilot testing is going to go until December, and then we're going to look at it. And obviously, the medical need, I feel, is strongly there. And then we're also going to look at it from the point of view of sustainability and paying for costs of the actual test itself.
And this is a gene that's handed down in a so-called autosomal dominant fashion, which means that there's a 50%, you only need one copy of the bad gene for you to get the illness in some shape
that's
or form.
Right. That's exactly right. So genes come in pairs and there's a spelling error in one of the copies. And so basically it's irrelevant if you're a man or a woman. If you have this condition or this gene fault, it's present in half of the sperm or the eggs that you have. So for every child you have, there's a 1 in 2 or 50% chance it'll be passed down. And it's like tossing a coin. The coin has no memory. So if you've had one affected child, the chance for the next child is still 50-50.
And can you have pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, in other words, see whether or not a fertilised egg may have the condition?
It is technically possible to do that. The only thing is to work that test up may have technical problems, but certainly it would be feasible now. Like any condition where a gene and a gene fault has been identified, the possibility of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is available, and my patients and the community is becoming more aware and asking about these types of issues every day. The only thing that I might say is that, you know, a lot of these tests, there's a lot of splash in the media when the research is done, but I suppose the thing that makes us really proud and the families really happy is that we've now able to translate this test to actually do what we said we were going to do, which was to test other families with this condition. And the actual initial family that we developed the test on are really happy that we've actually made good on our promise, even though it's been some 6 years down the track. And it just goes to show how difficult it is to translate good research into clinical outcomes.
Associate Professor Ravi Savarirayan is at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and is also head of the Royal Children's Genetics Service in Melbourne. Another autosomal dominant inherited disorder where the risk of passing it from an affected person to their children is 1 in 2 is Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease affects a reasonable number of Australians, and it's been said that parts of the country have unusually high numbers because of migrants with the disorder arriving in the early days of the colony and spreading their genes far and wide through the generations. Researchers in the United States are working on a possible genetic treatment for Huntington's disease, which, if it works, could possibly be applied to other genetic problems. Neil Aronin is Professor and Chief of Endocrinology and Metabolism at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester.
Huntington's disease is usually manifest by age 40. It starts as a depression or cognitive disease. Then the patient experiences abnormal motor movement. Most patients with Huntington's disease become incapacitated as early as 10 to 15 years afterwards. In many ways, it's one of the worst diseases because there's a reduction in thinking, and the patient eventually becomes hospitalized, requires nursing care. The patient often knows that he or she is getting this disease, and there's no good treatment for it. Sometimes physicians will treat for the motor abnormalities, but not for the cognitive decline.
So it's decline in thinking ability, almost a dementia.
It's a type of dementia. The gene was discovered in 1993 and the mutation was identified. Then there were better tests for diagnosis. It was predicted in the usual jubilation that now that we know the gene, the cure is around the corner. It's been a very long corner.
And you've been looking for many years at both what causes the abnormalities in somebody with Huntington's disease and whether or not you can actually get around this corner.
Yes, we've been experimenting on how the mutant protein, the abnormal protein, actually causes the neuronal degeneration, the cell death, which occurs in certain areas of the brain. It became apparent to us after many years of studying this disease that there's not just one abnormality in the neuron, but many abnormalities. The nucleus of the cell is affected, movement of vesicles is affected.
And vesicles being little parcels that move through the cell.
Yeah, they're information packages that go throughout the cell. So almost every part of a neuron has been looked at, and some abnormality in those various parts has been found.
And so you went upstream in the nerve cell to say, well, why don't we go for the money, go for this abnormal protein called Huntington?
That's exactly right. One of my colleagues, Craig Mello, discovered a potential way in which we could silence a gene.
This was a Nobel Prize-winning discovery at the University of Massachusetts. It's essentially about stopping DNA in the genes, giving orders to the cell, telling it to make proteins. This communication involves another genetic material called RNA, which reads off the genetic message on the chromosomes, then takes the instruction into the cells to be read off by the factories which make the substances which keep us alive and well. Silencing RNA, siRNA, is a way of shutting out bad messages such as in Huntington's disease. Neil Aronin again, who, by the way, when he uses the word allele, means a copy of the gene.
We decided to design siRNAs that could distinguish between a normal allele, to make a normal messenger RNA and normal protein, and the abnormal or mutant allele, which makes the disease-carrying protein.
And you've tested this in rodents?
We're testing the idea of the RNAi treatment in rodents, and we found that treatment with siRNA can reduce by up to 80% mutant Huntington and reverse the neuropathology and ameliorate a lot of the abnormal behaviors that the mice have.
So there is a reliable mouse model of Huntington's?
There are several mouse models. We were able to have a model with neuropathology and abnormal behaviors within a week.
And when you gave the siRNA treatment, was it durable? In other words, it lasted or did it wear off?
This was a model system. This is not yet a treatment. With one injection, we were able to have lasting effects up to 2 weeks.
Which is a long time in a mouse's life.
For this particular mouse, it was a long time. Mice live on average a couple years, so we could have the idea that several treatments given periodically might be successful in reducing the disease.
So where do you go from here? Because it's a long road to get from mice to humans to see whether it works, particularly with anything that interferes with your genes and your RNA or DNA.
At least now we have tools, and that's what we're doing. We're developing tools and models so we can test this. Our next step is to show safety, and we need to do this. The RNAi is really a drug approach. In the parlance, it's called a druggable molecule. The idea then is to show safety, and we're doing that in many different ways, looking at the brain itself, neuropathology, molecules in the brain, like inflammatory molecules. And then we aim to move on to non-human primates to show safety in non-human primates. Once we show this is safe, then we might be able to apply it to humans. And that would be a phase one trial.
And presumably, this would work for other dominant diseases.
That's correct again. In theory, we should be able to eliminate a mutant gene, even if we can't attack the mutation itself.
So what sort of diseases could they be?
Well, there are at least eight other diseases that have a CAG repeat expansion. So those would come immediately to mind.
So what you're talking about here is that for some what are called neurodegenerative diseases that are inherited, there's this curious abnormality where the same little sequence of DNA is repeated. They're called triplets, and they keep on being extended abnormally. And so you end up with a much longer gene than you had before.
Yes. Sometimes the mutation is stable, but at times, especially when inherited from a father, the expansion can increase, and then the child who inherits that might have a juvenile or early form of the disease. But then there are other diseases that are autosomal dominant. For example, a hereditary form of Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis that has a point mutation. And that point mutation could be a target for RNAi. So, in fact, we've expanded our repertoire of possible siRNAs to target a disease gene. I sometimes get emails from around the world from people who
are desperate. This is not a treatment yet.
Yes, and I need to tell them that we're working hard. There is no curative treatment for this disease. However, at least now in theory, we have tools so that hopefully within my lifetime, we would have a viable treatment.
Neil Aronin is Professor and Chief of Endocrinology and Metabolism at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been The Health Report. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.